Welcome to our latest edition of Syracuse Speaks, encouraging community discussion on issues that affect us here in the region. Today, we want to discuss aging healthy. I'm WAER News and Public Affairs Director Chris Bolt, joined by reporter and host Katie Zilkowski.
And we really can't avoid aging, but as we grow older, our health, abilities to do the things we want and need, and how we live can be very different. In our conversation, we're going to discuss some of the physical realities of aging, as well as how finances can affect where we live and the choices we can make to age as happy and healthy as possible.
We'll also share some ideas about how to ensure the best chance for wellness as the years tick by, and what preparation for our advanced years might look like. Joining us in today's discussion is Dr. Sharon Brangman, the inaugural chair of the Department of Geriatrics and director of NAPI Longevity Institute at Upstate Medical University. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Cindy Woods, executive director of Upstate OASIS Senior Program and HealthLink Program. Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you.
And Dr. Douglas Tucker, medical director of PACE CNY and board of trustee member at Loretto Health.
Thanks.
All right, great. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to cover health issues, including cognitive and mental health concerns, finances and how they might impact health and living options, and finish up with some ideas of how you can age healthy wherever you are in that journey. But I wanted to start with asking some things about health. What are the most common elements and ailments you see people struggle with as they say crest 60 or 70 or beyond? Sharon, probably Dr. Brangman, probably most in your area.
So I think it's important to realize that aging is not a disease. It's something that starts as soon as we're born. So it is a developmental stage. It can be tough to handle, but it's not a disease. So I think the most common things we see are changes in the joints. You know, you get a little stiff in the morning. It takes a little longer to get moving. And osteoarthritis is one of the most common diseases that we see. It's kind of like the price we pay for walking on 2 feet. So people start to feel achy and they may not want to move as much, which is really the opposite of what you want to do because you want to keep moving. The other things that we see are people developing high blood pressure, maybe diabetes. Those are very, very common diseases as we get older.
Dr. Tucker, obviously you're dealing with people with a range of health concerns, maybe mild, some chronic. What would you say? What are the things that people are struggling with the most, again, as they crest 60 or 70 or even 80?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that go hand in hand. I think there's probably three major issues that affect people in the United States in general, and it's more amplified with age. And it's interesting if you compare the United States with other countries across the world. You know, oftentimes the U.S. healthcare system has been criticized, but we also have folks who are probably the most unhealthy, if that's really a word, in the world. And a lot of that's driven by the obesity epidemic. If you follow the trends that have happened, and the Centers for Disease Control has trended this over the years, and we've gone, our prevalence of folks who are, you know, in that category have increased by epidemic proportions over the last 30 years. So that leads to what Dr. Brangman was saying, you know, diabetes being an issue. And in the population that I deal with most often, probably half or more of the folks are affected by complications of long-term diabetes. Hmm. So, and oftentimes that's really what we look at as a preventable illness. The other thing that is problematic over time is the effect of alcohol. And I've seen that both professionally and personally in folks in my family and so on. And that's something that really has a lot of adverse effect on folks in our population.
So I just was wondering, we are talking here about the things that can seem obvious. Are there things that people overlook when they're aging, aspects of your physical health that you don't pay enough attention to until it's really affecting you?
So I think hearing and visual changes are very common and often denied. So I have many patients who have trouble hearing, and either they minimize it or they don't want to get an evaluation or hearing aids. And sometimes hearing aids may not optimally replace your hearing like you would like it. But when you can't hear well, you get cut off from social interactions. Hmm. And there's actually an association with being hard of hearing and losing some of your cognitive or brain power. Hmm. And the same thing with visual changes. Our eyes all change as we get older. You know, you start to have trouble reading fine print and your arm isn't quite long enough to read. But that can affect your ability to drive and to read labels on medications and that sort of thing. And I find that some people are reluctant to get their eyes evaluated and get the treatment they need so that they can see well. And when you don't get the right information into your brain, either through your eyes or your ears, then your brain may start to slow down and you lose what we call cognitive function, which may present as memory problems or confusion.
Yeah, actually, we're going to talk a little bit more about that in just a minute, and we're going to dive deeper into sort of wellness advice. But to what extent are the things you've talked about parts of lifestyle choices, diet, movement, maybe stress as we lump that on our lives, contributors to the health issues that people face as they age?
Well, lifestyle is a big issue. And better than any prescription I could write is for somebody who keeps moving as they get older. And that is the thing that we are most reluctant to do. Everybody looks for the parking spot closest to the store.
Right.
We now don't even have to get off of our couch to turn the television channel. So if I could advise people to walk every day and maybe do some weights and to move, that would help their blood pressure. It would help the way their body handles sugar and fat. It might reduce their diabetes. So lifestyle is a significant indicator of health and longevity.
OASIS programs are kind of wrapped up in a lot of that stuff, aren't they?
Yes, actually they are. And I'm listening to both Dr. Tucker and Dr. Bragman and thinking I might have the solution for a lot of these things.
So right in this catalog.
Exactly. I think, as Dr. Bragman said, as people become more and more isolated, and oftentimes there's a lot of transition that happens as later life approaches. Maybe you've lost your spouse or your loved one, and your circle seems to diminish. OASIS, for a lot of those people, is the answer because they can come, they can make new friends that are like-minded, that are similar in age, that have the same activity interests, and kind of reconnect and grow old together.
Now, I mean, growing old together, having these relationships, that does play a big role in mental health of people who are aging. So are there expectations that people should expect with their mental health as they go through the aging process?
So obviously, as we get older, there are many adjustments that we have to make. I have patients who live in the same house that they raised their kids in, but the neighborhood is different. The neighbors have moved away or passed away. They don't know any of the children anymore. Maybe their friends aren't nearby. Maybe their children moved out of town and their grandchildren are far away. Their health may not be the same. They may have lost a spouse or a partner. So there are a lot of adjustments. Depression can play a big role in how your whole body functions. We have increasing evidence that just being socially isolated can be just as deadly as smoking.
Wow.
So that people who are socially isolated and don't have day-to-day contact with people, with other humans, can have a whole host of medical problems. And this is all avoidable. There are interventions we can do. Some of the programs that Cindy mentions are just a few examples of it. And then we find that people who are more connected on tablets or electronics don't really do that well because we're really wired to have human contact, face-to-face contact and communication. So some people say, well, I'm connected online with my family. That is not the same as having in-person contact with people.
Yeah, and that negatively affects people in other ways. As you said, moving is really important. And the more the people sit in one place on their electronics, the less they're getting up and moving around. So, you know, that's a two-edged sword there.
And certainly during the winter months, we see a lot of people go into hibernation and they can get really cut off from people. They don't even have someone to shovel their sidewalk, for example. So just going out could be a hazard in terms of slipping and falling. So we really have to think as a community, what kind of community do we want to be? And if we want to age in place and do that well, what kind of services do we need to provide so that can actually happen? We are a very car-oriented city here, a very personal car-oriented city. So when people start to have trouble driving, they can become very isolated very quickly. We do have call a bus, but it's very awkward to use, and people are used to spontaneously going places,
right,
which you can't do with call a bus. I have patients who don't have smartphones, so they can't use Lyft or Uber or any of those kinds of services. And if we look at cities, say like New York City, where there is ample transportation, people actually can do better because not only can they get out, but people who provide them services can get to them easier. So people who provide these services often don't have the finances themselves to afford a car, and they rely on public transportation. So when I am helping families make plans for care, we have to look at who can provide that care and actually get to them.
And while I want to kind of piggyback on that a little bit, we realize that some of the situations that Dr. Bragman just mentioned are an issue. So we at OASIS have partnered with locations that are that also operate with the Office for Aging to bring some of our programming there for those transportation issues so that people can come to the centers and take advantage of Tai Chi for arthritis or other falls prevention programs. And then the other thing that is really exciting for us and fairly new is that we had a donor step up and offer $10,000 for a scholarship fund so that we could bring programming to underserved areas, as well as help people offset the cost of attending some of these programs that could help them with that social isolation of aging.
Talking about the programs that we have, I mean, are there programs that we don't have that this community needs right now? Is there a gap in programming? I mean, we talked a little bit about social isolation. Is there a way for us to have better programming as we learn about the things that affect us as we age?
Well, we actually have a lot of both provider barriers and also service barriers in our area, socioeconomic as well. I mean, we're one of the, I think I saw some statistics, they're one of the poorest counties in terms of, you know, local low income accessibility to other things. We have a shortage of psychiatric services in town. We don't have enough psychiatrists to go around and counselors. We also have, my very own specialty geriatrics and internal medicine and other primary care specialties are in a really short supply. So, you know, if you need to see a cardiologist, there's a lot of them around. But if you need to see a geriatrician, there's very, very few. So some of that's been selected by economics and by just number of people who get trained every year. So those things are difficult barriers that won't be, you know, won't be fixed anytime very, very soon. It's going to take many, many years to do that. And with our population aging, that's only going to get worse just because of the population distribution.
Although, will that push it? I mean, will the aging population in the area and many, many other areas as baby boomers get older, will that push medical schools or the system to have more people go into those things or put more resources? You're shaking your head no.
No, this is not demographically driven. Because we've known for years that the baby boomers were aging, and it has not changed that level of selection for specialty. We're facing a doctor shortage across the country, and we also have a shortage of those frontline hands-on workers who do the nursing aid jobs and help people with personal care. So already we're seeing people who can't get those services. They can't leave the hospital because it's hard to find someone to provide those home care services.
Right.
If we look across the country, there are nursing homes that are closing in rural areas, and there are people who can't get home care. They are marooned at home without that. So we have a shortage of younger workers with that full employment rate. And these tend to be jobs that pay on the lower end of the scale, and they require a lot of passion that sometimes surpasses the payment.
Yeah, it's hard work.
It's very hard. Yeah. It's very hard work, and you can get a job in a fast food place or in a store and get a store discount, and you have a defined shift, and your hands stay clean. So, again, this is a societal issue when we have a growing population of older adults who need services and limitations on what we can provide people.
Yeah, and it is a hard job doing personal care. And you know, I remember one of our aides was talking the other day and mentioning that, you know, this is not a job that's for anybody. Right. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people that can't do it. You have to have not only the ability, but the passion and the desire and the willingness to serve folks to do the job. It's really not an easy job.
The last area I wanted to get into as we're discussing just sort of health issues is, you know, we hear a lot about dementia and Alzheimer's disease. There are advances in these areas in diagnosing, finding out what it is with an individual. There's always the question about, like, how much forgetfulness is normal, how much is indicative of something that we need to look into. And is this discussion better framed as sort of cognitive abilities as we grow older, because there's a natural, but then there's also a disease factor?
So there's been a lot of discussion about that, especially in terms of the presidential campaign, for example.
Right.
Mm. And memory loss is not a normal part of aging. But as we get older, it takes longer to process information and to retrieve it. So I kind of explain it as you have a hard drive that's packed with information. It takes longer to go through the files, but you should still be able to go through those files and get the information you need. It just takes a little bit longer.
And that's normal.
And
that
that's
would be
normal.
Just normal aging. Yeah.
But of course, everyone panics the minute they can't remember someone's name or they misplace their eyeglasses or their car keys. And that's usually not Alzheimer's disease or dementia. So it's a distinct brain disease where you not only have problems with your memory, but you have problems with your function. You can't get through the day and make decisions that keep you safe or help you take care of yourself. So it's a much more global problem. And we do not have a cure for it.
Right.
It is a disease of aging. Although people in their 50s and 60s can get it, the majority of people who get it are in their 80s, 85 and above. Mm-hmm. And they often get it in conjunction with other diseases. So then it becomes a matter of managing their dementia, plus their hypertension, plus their diabetes, plus helping them get to the bathroom, plus
right.
their chronic pain from arthritis. So it kind of compounds everything that you have to do to take care of someone.
Dr. Tucker, obviously in Loretto's different properties, you have people everywhere on the spectrum. And I've noticed for just in my personal life, people who have been, say, in the 1 to 10 Alzheimer's scale, a 2, and then a 9, where they can't remember anybody's name and start even to lose physical functions. How are we dealing with this? I mean, you're dealing with it on different levels in different Loretto properties. Are we getting better at even figuring out how to manage or treat or, help people with Alzheimer's and their families, of course?
Yeah, that's probably a three-hour discussion.
Yeah, sorry, that's a big question.
But I can tell you just a couple of things. One is that, you know, we look at other diseases differently when you have a person that has rapidly advancing dementia, for instance. If, you know, someone with Alzheimer's disease that is farther along, you know, we have to be smart enough to know to focus on what's important.
Mm-hmm.
And our healthcare system is not really currently gauged to do that. If you look at someone and you know that because they've deteriorated as much as they have, that they're likely to only live a year, we shouldn't be sending them for screening colonoscopies for colon cancer. We shouldn't be sending them for mammograms. They shouldn't be set up for cardiac cath if they have a slight, you know, a little bit of chest pain somewhere, because we know they already have one fatal disease. So to chase other stuff just doesn't make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't aim for tight control diabetes anymore because, you know, if that complication would take 10 or 15 years to develop, they're not going to live long enough to do that. So it's really hard to convince families and patients of those things sometimes. So mm-hmm. that's one part of the whole management that's sometimes difficult. The other part is, you know, certainly we want people to stay at home as long as possible. But part of the problem that is ensuring their safety. And obviously we can't ensure everybody's safety. And people fall in a nursing home just as often as they fall at home. That still happens because they can't be watched, you know, every single second. So one of the thresholds that really determines where someone's going to live is what their degree of independence would be and whether they could be safe. You know, if someone can call for help at home, they're likely to be able to stay home longer than someone that can't. You know, once
right.
you can't call for help anymore or have 24-hour caregivers, then you're going to need to be in a more institutionalized setting. So there's really a whole spectrum of available places that people can live and levels of care.
Right.
And it really depends on that. And I think over time we've gotten better at providing more, but there's still not enough, for instance, areas where people with advanced, memory-related illnesses can go. That's a hard part right now.
Great. Thanks. Well, physical and mental health are key to aging healthy. Another factor that can shape the experience of aging is money. Coming up next, how financially prepared are most people as they age and retire, and how does that impact health and wellness?
Thanks to everyone who called or donated online during our fall member drive. And continued thanks to our renewing and sustaining members. The support of our listeners remains the most reliable source of funding for WAER. It's not too late to add your gift. All contributions received through the end of September will be added to the total. You can give securely online at waer.org.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks, our conversation about aging healthy. I'm Chris Bolt with WAER's Katie Zilkowski, and we're joined by Dr. Douglas Tucker from Pace CNY, Cindy Woods, Executive Director of Upstate Oasis, and Dr. Sharon Brangman, the inaugural chair of the Department of Geriatrics at Upstate Medical University. Research by AARP finds that nearly half of Americans age 55 and older lack any real retirement savings. That means no 401k or similar, no pension that they're going to have for a steady income, and they'll rely most likely on Social Security and Medicare. We're not going to have a seminar about retirement savings. That's probably a topic for other types of experts. But how are financial concerns affecting our health and wellness?
So it's a significant problem because when people are in the middle of it, that's when they think about it. And we find that people delay that kind of planning, and then they're in crisis mode. So Medicare only pays for hospital and doctor visits, and most people want to stay at home. So Medicare will pay for you to go to the ICU. Mm-hmm. But if you want to stay home and have someone come to your house to help you, you have to pay for that yourself. And even if people do have a nest egg, they can use that nest egg up pretty quickly because that kind of care is very expensive. So most of the time when we're having these conversations in the office, people say, well, what about Medicare? And we say...
And expect much more out of it than it really
covered. They expect much more from Medicare than it will actually pay.
At a time, you're suggesting that's way too late to have thought about this.
It's way too late. And when you think about people who have medical problems, they probably shouldn't be in the ICU using those Medicare dollars because usually that is not going to make them better. It's going to make them weaker and sicker. If we could use dollars to keep people at home, which is a lot less expensive, and have a good quality of life in a familiar environment where most people want to be, then that might be a better use of money, but that's a huge political discussion.
Right. It is one that's going on, though. I mean, people are talking about especially home care being covered by Medicare.
Yes, but I think...
But it's not very far along.
It is not coming out of Washington anytime soon because of all the other things that are happening in Washington. And when you look at nursing home care, that's primarily Medicaid.
Right.
So the sound bites that we normally get about Medicaid is that it's paying for women with multiple children who aren't being responsible. However, Medicaid is the primary payer for people in nursing homes. Mm. And people don't understand that. So even if you have a nest egg, you use it up pretty quickly, and then you need Medicaid to help you pay for nursing home care. So understanding some of those basics of finances are important, and you can't wait till you need it to understand it because by then it's probably too late.
And even Medicare doesn't cover all, for instance, drug expenses. And a lot of people spend a good portion of their nest eggs on, the donut hole expenses around Medicare drug coverage. And so that's a big deal, too. Drugs are more and more expensive. There's more things that are more expensive out there. And so that's another big load on a lot of people, looking at that as well.
And I was just going to jump in here because Medicare is often changing. each time the enrollment period comes around, we do offer some programming at OASIS and our HealthLink program to help people understand the changes in Medicare, what it means if you're new to Medicare, and how to use it most efficiently.
Gotcha.
I mean, as you all are mentioning, that seems like a complicated process to navigate. But what are some of the things that people don't think about until the moment? I mean, I think of nursing homes. Maybe you think that you'll cover it some other way, or medication, you don't really understand the cost of them. Is there something that you hear people over and over who are aging saying, I wish I would have thought of this sooner?
So I think we're all in a state of denial about getting older and being dependent on others to get through the day. Mm-hmm. And that's part of our whole cultural fear of the end of life. And so a lot of my patients say, I never thought I would end up this way. When I see them, they're ending up in a very typical scenario of several medical problems starting to pile up, and they get older, and they get weaker, and they have more trouble getting up out of a chair or getting on and off the toilet or getting up to use the bathroom at night, and they don't have anyone to fill in those gaps. So I think the first step is a real frank assessment of where we will all be as we get older and how we would like that to look. And you really need to start thinking about that when you're in your 30s, 40s, and 50s, because by the time you're in your 80s, the decision has already been made. But since we are such a youth-oriented culture, nobody wants to discuss it. We want to talk about getting rid of wrinkles and getting rid of gray hair, which there's nothing wrong with that, but that's only a superficial part of the bigger process. Mm. And granted, these are not easy decisions, but when you're in a crisis and you need this help, then your choices become very limited unless you've planned. So when we are often talking to families who are in a crisis, that's when it becomes an issue. And by the way, we are coming on our busy season. Our busy time of the year is Thanksgiving and Christmas. And that's because adult children who no longer live in Syracuse come home and they realize the conversations they were having with their parents over the phone do not reflect reality.
Wow, that's very interesting.
And yeah. Then they decide mom and dad aren't doing as well as they sounded on the phone, and now we need some help. And this needs to be wrapped up pretty quickly because I have to get back to California. So I think that having these discussions are very hard. Nobody wants to hear it, the adult children, the parents. But if we keep pushing it down the street and we don't talk about it, then it just explodes and then we're in a crisis.
And then we get to the point where anybody, especially older adults, don't like to lose their independence. They still want to be the decision makers. They still want to be in charge of what they do. They still want to, you know, have – I think everybody wants to have a purpose in life and an importance. And that, you know, is the same with folks as they age and they, you know, have other issues. But, you know, sometimes it's hard to get people to accept what might be the right thing for them because they have different ideas. And so that's another, you know, barrier we run into. And some of those things, you know, reflect really what the person might want. At the same time, those kinds of discussions need to take place usually earlier because people put them off to the last minute. We have the same problems when we do advanced directive planning, things like, you know, does someone want to have CPR? Do they want to go to the hospital? Do they want to have a feeding tube? Do they want to have IV fluids? All those questions are important ones to ask. And a lot of times, as Dr. Bragman was suggesting, those types of conversations don't happen until we're already in a crisis.
Maybe so, that financial discussion can happen at the same time as the advanced directive discussion.
Yeah. So it's all connected, and I have patients who want to pass on money to their children or their grandchildren, and they want to preserve their nest egg. And they are waiting for that rainy day, and they don't really see that rainy day when it is actually here. Hmm. And if you want to do that and pass things on, you have to plan that also.
Right.
You can't just expect it to happen spontaneously because no matter what our plans are, things do happen and you have to be prepared.
Well, and there's the Medicaid 5-year look back of resources, you know, if you are going to have to pay for some kind of a, you know, living situation other than living at home. I was going to say, I mean, one of the other impacts of having had your finances in order or not is the quality of life that you can have, and then wellness choices for you. It's very different. You were talking, Dr. Tucker, about living independently. You know, someone living at the Nottingham lives a very different life than somebody living in, you know, an advanced nursing facility, maybe because of health issues, but also because of finances. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I think options are better if you have more financial reserve, that's for sure. There's a lot of the nursing homes, for instance, you know, don't well, let's put it this way. Whenever they look, economics always you know, play a factor and you know, where you can live in terms of, you know, what places cost.
To pivot a little bit, we increasingly see older people still working jobs. And often that can be because they need the money. Sometimes it's because it's a way to stay cognitively active. What are some of the effects you see of people as they start working later and later in life?
So it's interesting because a 65-year-old, which is supposed to be the traditional time to retire, that was arbitrarily set, you know, many, many years ago, isn't the same 65-year-old that you see now. So there are people who do work into their 70s or 80s, some for financial reasons, some because it keeps them in the mix. They have social contacts. I think the most important thing is to have that sense of meaning and purpose. I think as human beings, if we don't have a reason to get through the day, or if we don't think that what we're doing is meaningful, that has a huge effect on our overall mood and physical functioning as well.
I just want to jump in here and say, in Syracuse, several years ago, there was a study done to show that Syracuse was like number 10 on the most digitally divided cities. Mm-hmm. So there are many people in that age group that are coming into a need to go back to work, and they don't have the skill set that they need to do some of like the iPad kiosk work, and, you know, just a simple cashier may not be as easy for someone as it was 25 years ago.
Or even a job application. A lot of those
are online
now.
Everything is online. Right, exactly.
And so that digital divide, that really affects people who didn't grow up as digital natives in a financial way sometimes too, because if they're trying to navigate these spaces without the skills, it becomes a barrier.
And so, then like Dr. Bragman said, you have the people who don't even have the smartphone access. So there's another barrier to someone who needs a job in getting one.
So we used to call these unskilled jobs, but they really require a lot of skills because the computer is the basis of just about every job that we have now. The computer in the supermarket, everywhere you go, it's computer-based. And so older adults may need a special training. But we also see professionals or other managers and workers who may work part-time but may not want to just sit home.
No, sure. One aspect of working later is that you want to.
Because
at 75, you can get up every morning, you're fine, et cetera, and you want to have that part-time physical interaction and sense of purpose, as you mentioned.
I want to go back to our cognitive discussion we had earlier for a second, because this made me think of something else, and that part of the whole purpose in life in terms of, you know, people wanting to have a need to get up in the morning, so to speak. It goes back to the whole issue of, you know, if you can keep moving, as Dr. Bragman said, well, it's not just moving physically, but it's also moving mentally. And there's been a lot of studies now that have come out to talk about if people keep their brains active as well, you know, that may actually either, you know, prevent earlier onsets of dementia, or if nothing else, you know, be able to compensate for people, other decompensations in terms of potential cognitive function. So, you know, folks need to stay mentally engaged too, not just physically engaged. And that, whether that means, you know, getting up and doing your crossword puzzle in the morning, or, you know, playing a game of chess, or, you know, doing something else mentally engaging. And that doesn't mean just watching television. It means doing something that's really mentally engaging. And that I think is something we have to really think about in terms of, you know, where our elders are moving. And, you know, whether if it's a job, then that sometimes is mentally engaging. And that's you know, you talk about losing your sense of purpose when you retire. That's a big deal for people. It really is. And the work is folks' identity. It's, you know, it's interesting because you ask people. I find it really interesting when you ask people, you know, who they are, what they are. They almost always identify themselves as a profession.
Right, you know? As what your job was.
Yeah,
right?
And you know, it's interesting because I've asked women that question, and it's interesting that a woman with several children might, her first answer might be, well, I'm a manager at a store. Well, okay, but you have three children, and oh yes, well, I'm a mother. But you know, what do they put first? You know, what's your identity? Your identity is almost always your profession. And when people retire and are, you know, they lose that part of their identity.
And I've spoken to those people, and so they come and say, you know, I didn't have a plan when I retired. I didn't know what I was going to do. There wasn't anything for me after retirement. And I stumbled into this OASIS program, and this really saved my life because now I had a purpose. I took a class. I made some new friends. You know, I decided to join the intergenerational tutoring program so then I could go into the schools and give back. And these kids loved to see me, but it was that purpose-filled life that they were seeking, and they managed to find with that connection.
We've been talking about what changes as we get older, and coming up, we'll take a look at what people are doing to make these changes easier on themselves and how you can make them easier for those who you love that are aging. This is Syracuse Speaks from 88.3 WAER. WAER is happy to be part of your community, but we realize that a lot of times you're on the go. Or maybe you can't connect with WAER. And that's why we've developed the WAER mobile app, so you can take us with you wherever you go. Stream our broadcast, browse our website, and listen to the latest on-demand audio. Available in the Apple and Google Play Store, just search for WAER. Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks. We've been talking about healthy aging. Just ahead, we'll talk with our panelists about the work being done to ease transitions and how to help those around you aging. With us here, we have Dr. Sharon Brangman, the inaugural chair of the Department of Geriatrics at Upstate Medical University, Cynthia Woods, the executive director of Upstate OASIS's senior program, and Dr. Douglas Tucker, medical director of PACE CNY. So we were talking a little bit even on our break here about the complexities that come with healthcare, and those complexities make transitioning into aging harder. So is there any programming, any work being done trying to make those who are going through the process more aware before they get into moments of crisis where they need care now or they need new jobs now because they are having an identity crisis? I mean,
I think that goes back to our denial about getting older. Mm. And I don't think too many people are open to the conversation till they're in the midst of it. And then we'll have a little bit of a window when an adult child is bringing in their parent and they say, well, what should I do so I don't have these problems?
That's interesting.
But even then, that window closes because it's so overwhelming. And I don't think people often can hear it until there is a crisis. And I always say, you age well, you have to start with good prenatal care, because this is a continuum. This doesn't just all of a sudden happen. And so you have to start thinking, and when you're a middle-aged adult, what is my aging going to look like? You have to plan your retirement. You have to plan your health care. You have to plan your finances, because if you don't, then choices are going to be made for you. And as Dr. Tucker said earlier, we want to remain autonomous. We spend our whole adult lives being able to make decisions for ourselves and come and go as we please. And in order to retain that, then you also have to go that next step and make sure you plan it. Because if you don't, then that might be taken away from you, and that's even harder.
And I think that one of the other things that people don't plan for necessarily, and something we talked about earlier, is social interaction and how important and key that is when aging. So can you talk a little bit about the benefits of having a really strong social network and also how social networks change when you get older?
So we need to have people who are face-to-face, who we can talk to and interact with. And those relationships often start with family. They may be in the workplace, and they could be neighbors. And then as we get older, a lot of those relationships can change as children move away or neighbors move away or die. And And so we have to be flexible. One of the key parts of aging is to be able to adapt and be flexible. And the human spirit is very good at that, but we need some help. And so there are programs like OASIS, but we also have to be able to reach people who may not know about these programs or who may be reluctant to talk about their needs and seem dependent, because a lot of people really feel that they should kind of grit their teeth and make it happen without any help. So we have to create an environment where people can talk about these things. I think this is a societal issue where we can start to have these conversations when there aren't immediate consequences.
Yeah, I think there's a couple other things I wanted to add to that, too, is that, you know, having a medical provider that sort of can help organize all this stuff is important. Everyone has a whole, well, I shouldn't say everyone, but a lot of folks, as they get older, develop a fairly large group of specialists that they see. And if you have someone who can kind of help organize all that and coordinate it and make sure that you know, your care is centered in one place, essentially, because, you know, when you get prescriptions from two or three or four different doctors, you got to make sure that things are all compatible and that the medical regimen makes sense for that person. So that's important, I think, to have a center of primary care. And it's harder and harder these days to find a primary care physician or nurse practitioner. But that's, I think, a pretty important piece. And, you know, that's one of the strong points in programs like PACE, where we actually have the primary care giver as the center of the program in terms of the medical care. So I think that's really difficult, I think, for people to understand the complexity of their illnesses sometimes and to be able to have it all coordinated in one place.
So if we're looking from a medical perspective, we do not have the curriculum in a lot of health professional schools that train everyone from doctors and nurses to physical therapists, respiratory therapists, on an aging person, an aging body, somebody who has more than one disease and taking more than one medication. And so we are looking at ways to improve the curriculum in all of these schools so that not only primary care docs, but specialists have a sense of it. If you look at the medical field, except for pediatrics, and maybe obstetrics, you're going to be seeing older adults. Older adults are the ones getting surgery. They're the ones going to rheumatologists, to dermatologists, to orthopedic surgeons. So it's important that every specialty, whether it's a physician or a nurse, has some understanding of aging. And right now, older adults are the patients nobody really understands or gets. And so we often see people getting too much medicine that may not be meeting their needs, but it's the most expedient thing to do is to write a prescription.
Right.
And then many of these medicines weren't really tested in older people. So then there's a lot of reactions. So you need someone, as Dr. Tucker said, who can do that big picture, do a full assessment, see how your brains work in your body, look at your medications, look at your social connections, your family ties, maybe look at safety issues around your home so that you can start to be proactive and plan and make decisions before you're in a crisis.
Just getting back, Cindy, go ahead, what were you going to say?
I was just going to kind of piggyback on that and say that I think culturally and generationally, too, there's folks that don't, you know, they may not understand everything their physician or their healthcare provider is telling them. And they may not know the questions to ask. So we offer some of the community education side of things with programming that will help people understand how to talk to their physician, how to describe their pain, how to understand maybe their nutrition status so that they can eat better and be healthier or as healthy as they can with the conditions that they have. There's Stanford University evidence-based programs, and we take them all around the community so that we use a peer-led training so that people are being trained in these programs to deliver them to the people that they know so that there's the trust that's already been earned. So we have trained people to go into different church groups, different community centers, but we can help with just the chronic diseases that they have. There's another program that's dedicated to diabetes self-management, and we have one now that's chronic pain self-management. So we're working in ways to educate the community so that they can have these conversations with the healthcare providers and understand and make the best choices that they can for themselves.
And you mentioned something, as healthy as you can expect. One of the things I wanted to discuss just really quickly, quick answer is, I think we all kind of get to this sense as we approach our 50s and 60s and 70s is like, what's normal? We talked about it in terms of cognitive abilities, but, you know, as somebody gets to be 50, I realize you can be running marathons and you can be, you know, invalid and still not even be, you know, obese or have diabetes or something. Like, there's a wide spectrum, but there certainly are things that happen to the body. What is normal to expect? How healthy can you expect to be? Or what things should you prepare for if we're talking about preemptive aging to make sure you need to deal with that in your 50s and in your 60s and then 70s and beyond?
Well, maybe I'll sound crazy by saying this, but I think you are as young as you think you are. And I think folks, you know, if you have a lifestyle that is healthy and, you know, you don't overeat, you make smart food choices, you move every day, you do something every day to help you stay physically healthy and physically, you know, active, you get yourself into a weight program, you get yourself into a walking program or running or bicycling or swimming or something like that on a regular basis. I mean, and you really make an effort to do that. I mean, how many of us really pick being healthy as one of our important goals of the day? It's more like goals are more like, gee, you know, I got to get to work on time and I got to do this, and this, and I got to go shopping and I got my favorite TV show to watch. I got to, you know, that's a lot of people's primary priorities. And it's not easy to always do that. But I think, you know, if you look at, and Dr. Bregman mentioned that 65 now is not what 65 used to be. Part of that is because we've grown up in an environment with fewer hazards, you know, a better nutrition and, you know, a medical care that didn't happen years ago. But I think, you know, there's no reason why a lot of us can't live to be healthy and active late into our 90s and 100s. I think it's just, I honestly think we'll start seeing life expectancies of select people who choose to be healthier. You know, look, 100's not going to be that old anymore.
Although, but isn't the 65 is not what it used to be, both good and bad? Good because people can attend to their health and don't have the hazards, et cetera, but also bad because some lifestyle choices, you know, we're more obese, we're more likely to have hypertension and diabetes, we're more likely to be isolated because of electronic devices.
Well, aging well doesn't necessarily mean aging without disease, because at some point we all get something. It means that you also learn how to manage it and optimize it, so that you're working at the highest level you can and you're working for the highest quality of life you can. So I have patients that have lists of medical problems that would floor most people, and they're getting up every day and they're doing things and they're still part of their community. So I think the point is that even healthy people may get a problem, but you get it addressed and then you figure out how to adapt your lifestyle so that you can work this into your routine and it doesn't make you stop doing what you like to do. It may change it a little bit, but you still work on ways of maintaining the highest quality of life you can.
So we've been talking about what to expect preemptively aging here, but coming up, we'll discuss what you can do individually to make sure that you are aging healthy. This is Syracuse Speaks from 88.3 WAER. You hear a lot of stories during the day from NPR and WAER. Some of these stories you may want to share with friends or just listen to it again. At WAER.org, we're posting these stories to keep you up to date. We're also posting extended content, photos, and links to give you more of the local news that you rely on. Visit WAER.org for more. Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks. We've been talking about healthy aging, and in this last segment, we'll talk about effective ways to age healthy and how you can find joy in aging. With us, we have Dr. Sharon Brangman of Upstate Medical University, Cynthia Woods of Upstate Oasis, and Dr. Tucker from PACE CNY. We've covered a lot in this shows so far. So I want to open it up to the group here and ask each of you what you think you should prioritize in aging in order to have the best life expectancy possible.
I'm going to echo what Dr. Bragman said earlier. I think I said it again, but I can't say it enough times. Just keep moving. Keep moving. Do something active every day. And that I think has – and there's so many studies that show that aerobic activity and even weight training will do so many things to prevent falls, improve cardiovascular health, and those things will all, in my opinion, increase longevity and healthy longevity for that matter.
Just stay engaged in the community, and for some folks, just give back is enough for them, you know, just to stay active in the community.
So, yeah, you have to engage your mind and your body. And people who maintain that curiosity or interest in things around them tend to do better. And stay engaged with people in person as much as you can. Tablets and the internet are great to some degree, but you need to have that person-to-person contact to really make a difference.
How much of this is attitudinal as opposed to, you know, behavioral? Because I read a Harvard study about how confidence ebbs after 60 and then actually plummets later because you just get disappointed about what you can do, what you look like, et cetera, which leads to depression, which leads to less physical activity, et cetera. And they were sort of suggesting that you actually have to challenge yourself to stay mentally active, as you were saying, Cindy, or physically active, as you were saying, Dr. Tucker. What's your take on that? How much of it is an attitude and mental approach as opposed to the actual activities?
Well, I think it's 100% attitude, because attitude drives all your behaviors. And I'll never forget, one of my employees has a sign on her wall that says, "The only disability in life is a bad attitude." And I think that was Scott Hamilton, the figure skater's comment, who came back from, you know, some pretty bad physical things to become a gold medalist, you know. And you know, when I'm inspired by people who have incredible physical disabilities who are able to do amazing things. And those folks can only do it because their attitude's in the right direction. And that inspires me, and I look to my own life and say, you know, I'm a pretty privileged individual, and I've had a lot of, you know, good things I've been able to do. But you know, it's at the same time, if I had a lousy attitude, I wouldn't be wouldn't have accomplished most of what I've done. So I look back on that, you know, I think attitude is huge.
So I have patients with long lists of medical problems who still find joy and figure out a way to get things done. I remember a patient I had a number of years ago who was losing his vision due to macular degeneration, which is a serious eye problem. And he said, "Oh, I always wanted to learn how to use Braille." So that didn't stop him.
That's an ultimate turning lemons into lemonade right there.
And we were all floored by that. I see people with dementia who should be completely knocked down, and they are still trying to stay engaged and do things that are important. So I do think attitude does have something to do with it. We have to maintain that ability to adapt to our circumstances. And we don't have control a lot of times on things that happen to us. Even if we do stay healthy, things can still happen. You have to figure out how to adapt and still have a good quality of life.
What would you say, any of you, to people who aren't old yet, who haven't reached 50, who are but it's starting to get into their head? I mean, there's the classic diet and exercise, you know, keep your weight down, stop smoking, are the things that just come up 1,000 times and are still, I assume, true. Are those still the biggest pieces of advice you'd give somebody who is thinking about how they are living now and how that might impact their life? If they're 45 now, what they're going to be like at 55 and 65 or what have you?
I've started to think more about, you know, about barriers. And, you know, why do people do things that are, for instance, why are they not doing the healthy behavior? Why are they doing the unhealthy behavior? And I think that, you know, having us help figure some of that out, I think is a big thing, even for, you know, younger folks. And, you know, I was a private practice for a long time, and I saw a lot of those people who were, you know, in a situation where they were probably making not the healthiest choices in their lives. And the thing is, it's frustrating when you can't impact them. But I think part of that is just not figuring out what those barriers are and getting past them.
So Dr. Bregman, you referenced it sort of in the beginning of our conversation here, but our culture around aging and our perceptions of what it means to get older. Is there a way, or is there something you would say to people who are scared of aging or think it's a bad thing as opposed to a natural part of life?
Well, consider the alternative. I don't know too many people who want to die young.
Yeah.
And it's been happening for centuries. So I think, sure, if you want to dye your hair or take care of wrinkles, that's one thing. But I would look at those things that are the essence of what we can do to make a difference in our quality of life as we get older. And instead of putting your energy into fighting it, put your energy into attaining it. And I think that's important. Another piece, I think, are intergenerational contacts. Because I don't think we have enough interaction with people who are different than us in general. And that can be from culture and ethnicity and race, but also from age. Hmm. And so I look at ways that we can have intergenerational contact, because that will help younger people see older people as vital and important. One of the courses that we teach at Upstate is to try to encourage that interaction. We get a lot of our ideas about older people from the media, and they are usually negative stereotypes. You know, you have the older lady who's a cougar, or some old man who can't hear and is overly sexual, or they smell funny. And those are things that people start to incorporate when they don't have regular interactions with people. And that becomes another barrier. So we have to figure out a way how to interact with everyone. If you have an older neighbor, maybe you can shovel their driveway. Maybe when it's really hot, make sure that they're getting a drink. Maybe go and share some computer information with them if you're younger. And in turn, you will find a lot of wisdom and a lot of good experience that come from older people. One of the reasons why I love geriatrics so much is that I hear stories from my patients of things that they overcame, things that you would think would floor you. And here they are sitting in front of me. They've flourished. They still have families and they still have contacts. So we lose that sense of what struggles people come to through. And if you look at an older person, they are survivors. So if we change that context, if somebody's in their 80s or their 80 or their 85, think of all the younger people who have died and haven't made it there. So what has helped that person survive? I've been taking notes, and the younger people should also. And so I think if we change that perspective, we will see a wealth of wisdom and resiliency and knowledge that we should all be experiencing.
I think that's a really good place to leave it. Thanks for listening to Syracuse Speaks, Aging Healthy. We hope you learned something about navigating the aging process in a way that adds to your health and wellness, perhaps something that helps you in that journey or helps someone else in your life. I want to thank Dr. Douglas Tucker, Medical Director of PACE-CNY and Board of Trustee member of Loretto Health. Thanks.
Thank you.
Cindy Woods, Executive Director of Upstate OASIS Senior Program and Health Link Program. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Dr. Sharon Bragman, the Inaugural Chair of the Department of Geriatrics and Director of NAPI Longevity Institute at Upstate Medical University. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
If you want to hear this program again or share it with someone else, go to our website, waer.org. You can also find other Syracuse Speaks content there. Again, that's waer.org. With WAER's Katie Zielkowski, I'm Chris Bolt, News Director. Thanks for listening.